Good morning. Did you hear me there? We're loud. Well, maybe the special guest speaker this morning doesn't have a really good voice, so we've got him turned up good, because this morning we are blessed to have with us John the Apostle. I know you're thinking, wow, that's a little unique. But we're going to have a first-person narrative lesson where we're going to allow John, through his words in Scripture, to share with us some things that I believe he would want to share with us today. But before we talk about and do that, let me introduce John and make sure you know who John is. John is, of course, the son of Zebedee and Salome, who were likely very influential people because often in their descriptions, they are called, James and John, the sons of Zebedee. And they were known by the high priest during the trial of Jesus, so it's likely that Zebedee had some influence. And Salome, their mother, is going to be seen providing some financial resources and other care for Jesus. He was a fisherman, and he's going to grow up in his father's business, likely being a fisherman along with his friends and possibly relatives, Peter and Andrew. And they're going to become early disciples and one of the apostles of Jesus. He's going to be in the close inner circle of Jesus. We think about Peter, James, and John as that close group of three disciples who are going to spend much time with Jesus. John's going to be with Jesus, for example, and able to witness the event that took place of the Transfiguration. He's going to be able to go to the Garden of Gethsemane with James and with Peter. And he's also going to be one of the only witnesses, along with Peter and James, of the raising of Jairus' daughter. He's going to be there with Jesus in the upper room and lay his head on Jesus' bosom. And so John is a close friend of Jesus. He grew up in the Galilee area and was part of the fishing business. He wrote the Gospel of John, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, and the book of Revelation. And he was exiled on the Isle of Patmos and is thought to have been the only apostle that does not die a martyr's death. What would John say to us? Well, we don't really know for sure, do we? But John has written much of the New Testament. If you think about John, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, which those books are pretty short, but John, the Gospel, and the book of Revelation are rather lengthy in their amount of words and verses. So we know a lot of what John would say. You add that on of what we have in regard to the Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and what they record about John as an apostle, and we have quite a bit of information. So this morning, I'm going to speak in first person, as if I am John, talking to you to try to help this lesson be a little more impactful upon your life. My little children, I appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak to you. And I want to do that in several ways. The first part, I want to talk to you about my time with Jesus. It seems whenever I get to speak to an audience like this in the church, people want to know what it was like to be with Jesus. When I look back on those days, of course, I have many fond memories, but I'm also saddened. Because when I think about those days, I wasn't near the man that I should have been. In fact, I was a very overconfident, brash, self-assured man. In fact, Jesus gave us a nickname. It wasn't a very good nickname. It was the Sons of Thunder. Because we were often speaking when we should not have been speaking. And we were often quick to be judgmental and harsh. The Gospels record two stories that I'm not proud of now. The first one is when we were traveling, it was near Jesus' death, and we were traveling down for the Passover in Jerusalem. And Jesus, because he loved all people, didn't go around Samaria like the rest of the Jews did, but Jesus instead took us right through Samaria. And we needed a place to stay, so Jesus sent ahead some messengers to get us a place to stay. But the Samaritans, who did not like Jews, and of course I didn't like Samaritans, they would not allow us to stay. They wouldn't put any place for us to stay. There was no room in the inn, you might say, but not because there was no room, but rather because they didn't like us and they didn't want us going to Passover. And so my brother and I came up with a good idea. We asked Jesus, we said, Jesus, do you want us? You see that arrogance? Do you want us to call down fire upon these Samaritans? You see, Elijah, years before in this same area, had called down fire upon some of his enemies. And I was upset. I was angry. I mean, the audacity of these Samaritans not to even give us a place to stay. And so I said to Jesus, Jesus, let's just call fire down on them. And I thought Jesus would go for that. I mean, God in the Old Testament sent down fire. Jesus rebuked us strongly. I was embarrassed. My judgmental, my racist attitude, my harshness. Later on, many of those people would likely become Christians. And there I was wanting to call fire. And the arrogance of me to think that I had the power to bring fire upon them. Jesus, do you want me to bring fire upon them? Like I could do that. Sad. Another incident that I'm not proud of has to do with wanting to be great. And I know this is an issue you struggle with in your culture too. Growing up, my family had some prominence and we were pretty influential and we had some money and things. And then I became an apostle and I was looking around and I noticed that I was a part of this inner group and I was thinking that Jesus kept talking about His kingdom and He kept talking about what it would be like in His kingdom. And I was thinking that I wanted to be in a prominent place in my kingdom. And so I talked to my mom. In fact, my brother and I came up with this idea. And we talked to our mom, and we thought our mom would be the best, so it wouldn't look like we were the ones doing it outwardly. We would get our mom to talk to Jesus about us getting the best seats in the kingdom, to sit on His right and His left side in the kingdom. So our mom goes to Him and says, would you give James and John these best seats? And Jesus says it's not His to give. And He says, but this question, He asks, will you be baptized with the baptism that I'm going to be baptized with? To show you our arrogance, we said, well, yes, we are able. And Jesus said, you don't know what you're talking about. And we certainly didn't. We didn't know what He was talking about. You see, we thought He was talking about glory, and Jesus was talking about a cross. My brother James would go on to be martyred by Herod Antipas. I would go on to suffer many persecutions and then be put on the Isle of Patmos, exiled away. It took me a while to learn what the baptism Jesus spoke of was. But thankfully, through the power of the Spirit, we were able to undergo it. And then Jesus, after we ask Him about being the greatest, Jesus says, and the Gentiles, they want to argue about who's the greatest in their kingdoms, but it's not going to be that way in my kingdom. In my kingdom, He says it's going to be about service. For Jesus said He came not to be served, but to serve and give His life as a ransom for me. And how did I not get it? I mean, I saw Jesus constantly ministering and serving and healing people. And yet, the whole time I was thinking, can I get the best seat? Can I be second right behind Jesus? And I missed the sermon. I mean, it was just whoosh, right over me. The first shall be last. And then in my kingdom, it's about service. And that's why in John's gospel, the gospel I wrote, I recorded in chapter 13, the most embarrassing story, but the story that caused me to finally get it. When Jesus, when all of us had dirty feet, and we're all around that room, and we're all there, and we're ready to observe the Passover, and Jesus takes a towel and a wash basin and washes my feet, and Judas's feet, and Peter's feet, and on we go. And then after He washed our feet, He stood up and He said, I have given you an example that you should do likewise. And I realized that Jesus wants me to be a servant. My time with Jesus, I could tell you a lot, but I really wanted to tell you that I made a lot of mistakes because I was selfish and overconfident, and I was focused on myself, and I wasn't focused upon serving others. And what Jesus taught me was that in His kingdom, His way was about service and about love. I could tell you about all the miracles. There's so many stories. I could tell you what it was like and how humbling it was for me to be at the foot of the cross and Jesus to say, "Into your hands, I'm giving you my mother." And for me to have that responsibility of taking care of His mother. And it's sad that people have adorned her. She was a sweet lady, but she never deserved worship. She was only an instrument in the hands of God, just like you and I. I could tell you about what it was like when I ran to that tomb and I went into the tomb and I believed when I saw those garments laid over to the side and I recognized and realized that Jesus had been raised. There's a lot. In fact, I wrote in the end of my gospel that the world could not contain all that could be written about Jesus. So much I could tell you. But I want you to think not only about my time with Jesus, but I need to spend a little bit of time telling you about my books that I wrote. I hope you read them regularly and study them. The first book I wrote was John's Gospel. And in that book, my whole purpose was to convince belief in Jesus Christ. And I arranged it very simply. I put seven signs in it. Seven signs to show the unbeliever that Jesus is the Son of God. It begins with the water, turning water into wine. And then it moves to the healing of the nobleman's son. And then it picks up when in that book we talk about the healing of the paralytic, the feeding of the 5,000, the walking on water. And then you have when I use the healing of the blind man in John 9 to represent how Jesus is the light. And then ultimately the greatest one that is the climax of these signs, the resurrection of Lazarus. And I wanted to prove by those seven signs that Jesus is the Messiah. These are the signs to show He is who He claimed to be. Look what He did. And each of them represent in some way a different power Jesus has. But I not only put the seven signs in there, I put seven statements Jesus made that describes who He is. The I Am statements. Jesus would make seven of these statements that I record in my gospel to identify and define who He is. Because I didn't want only people to believe in Him as a person and not know who he was. You see, Jesus was also the bread of life. I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world. I am the door. I am the good shepherd. I am the resurrection and life. I am the way, truth, and life. And finally, Jesus said, "I am the true vine." Each of these statements come off of that Hebrew phrase, "I am," because I wanted the audience to read my book and know that Jesus is the great I am. He is the one that long ago, the son of the one long ago who revealed himself to Moses when he said, "I am who I am." And now Jesus comes along and Jesus says, "I am all of these things." When you read John's gospel, don't miss the fact that Jesus is the Son of God, and it is to inspire belief within Him and to follow Him. I also wrote three epistles, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, much shorter than the Gospel and Revelation. But in these epistles, I wrote them to the church and to individuals. And in them, they deal with some very key themes that the church was dealing with then and the church is still dealing with. For example, the first epistle of John deals with the issue of fellowship. That we have fellowship with Christ and we're blessed to have fellowship with one another. Brethren, you are different from people in the world. You are to love one another. You have a family relationship. And it saddens me because sometimes today I think that you don't get it like my generation got it. Because we were persecuted by the outside world. They were pagans. And so it was crucial that you stayed close and you depended upon your fellow brethren in Christ. I talked a lot about fellowship. And in my epistles, I emphasize love. Love for one another. You know, I'm often called the apostle of love. What's sad is that I also emphasize truth a lot, and I'm not focused on that. People don't notice that about my writings, but I actually mention truth many times. And one of the things that I talked a lot about in those epistles was that we need to walk in truth. That truth is not something we just believe, but truth is something we do. And that if we're going to have proper love for one another, it's going to be also by following the truth. And I talked about doctrine, especially in those smaller epistles of 2nd and 3rd John, that people must remain in the doctrine of Christ, that they must follow the truth. And I wrote, no greater joy that I had than when my brethren walk in truth. You live in a world today where truth is scoffed at, where people make fun of truth, where people say you can't even know truth. My letters, especially 1 John, are black and white. You're either walking in darkness, you're either walking in light. You're either loving or you're hating. You're either keeping the commandments or you're disobeying the commandments. That's truth. Truth has not gone out with time. Walk in truth. I also, in my epistles, warned you strongly about the world. The world was so prevalent then and it's just as prevalent today. You might remember one of my famous sayings, do not love the world for all that is in the world, the lust of the eyes, the lust of the world and the pride in possessions or the pride of life. All that is the world and the world is passing away. Don't love the world. The world is tempting. You see, all the world wants to do is influence you and pull you down and make you look like everybody else. Don't love the world. Here's how you win the victory over the world. Remember what I said? Faith is the victory. We have overcome the world through our faith. In my epistles, I emphasize fellowship, love, truth. And I emphasized our distinctiveness as Christians. And then there's that last book I wrote, when I was on exile in Patmos. And it's the book that's been twisted and abused and misunderstood. And yet, it's such a powerful and beautiful book. The book of Revelation. I wrote it when I was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day. And the key thing of the book is that it is given visual pictures as best I could put in words inspired by the Spirit of what I saw. So that you could have a glimpse behind the curtain, if you will, into the great struggle between good and evil, between the great struggle between Jesus and Satan, and ultimately to the great victory that Jesus has over Satan. And the book is meant to inspire people who are struggling with suffering, to inspire people who are struggling with the world. And the book talks a lot about Satan's weapons. A false religion, a false doctrine, a power and intimidation. And I wanted you to be able to see the power of Jesus riding the white horse, the power of Jesus treading out the wine presses of His wrath, the power of Jesus with the sword coming out of His mouth and eyes of flame, the power and the beauty of thinking about Jesus when one day He will be united to His church in that heavenly wedding ceremony, and that heavenly banquet will be prepared. And then we'll be those two concluding chapters in heaven with God, where there'll be no more pain, no more sorrow, no more death, when God shall wipe away every tear. And I described heaven as best I could. I know it's a feeble attempt, but with those streets of gold and those tremendous walls and gates and all those beautiful jewels adorning its walls. Oh, heaven's going to be a beautiful place. And the key emphasis was God and Jesus are there. When you read Revelation, don't get lost in all the details. See the picture and be inspired that Christians win. And though you're struggling now, you can overcome through the blood of the Lamb. Those are my books. Read them, love them, study them. And the beautiful thing about those books, they apply to the issues you face today just as much as they did to the issues the church faced then. The final area I want to mention before I close. You know, sermons are a lot shorter today than they were back when I preached. I didn't hear any amens on that being good, but I want to close by emphasizing what I want most for my little children. When I would speak as an older man, I would often use that refrain. In fact, you'll find it often in my letters, my little children. The first thing that I want you to know is you've got to find the balance between love and truth. Between love and truth. Study my epistles, and you will see that there is a balance in Christianity. But sadly, over the last 2,000 years, people want to go to one or two extremes. People either want to err away on the side of love, which means love without truth is like having flesh with no backbone. It won't stand up. It just crumbles. You see, truth is necessary. It's what we believe. It's our doctrine. It is essential. So don't throw out truth. But truth without love is indecent and legalistic. And it's unchristian. You see, what Jesus brought, and I wrote this in the prologue of my gospel, is He brought grace and truth. He brought us kindness and undeserved favor. He brought us salvation, but He did it through truth. We are to be a people that have love and truth. Find the balance. Don't throw one of them out. Remember, love and truth, they go together in Christianity. Second thing I want to emphasize to my little children is that you need to love one another. Love one another. When I was an old man, the legend is that they would put me up in front and I would stand up, and I couldn't preach long sermons then, and I would just say, "My little children, love one another." Remember in my epistle I wrote that the love that Christ had for us in John 3:16 was that God loved us. But in 1 John 3:16, the love we're supposed to have for one another is the same love. We're supposed to be willing to die for our brethren. And remember I said, let us not love in word, but let us love in deed and in truth. You've got to love with your actions. Love one another. You're not always going to find that everybody's going to be the kindest to you. Sometimes they're going to have a bad day. Forgive them. Sometimes your wife or your husband is going to get on your nerves. But love them. Sometimes the preacher is going to be off on his sermon, or he's going to forget you, or the elders are going to make a bad decision. Love one another. My little children, remember what Jesus said. They will know you are my disciples because you love one another. Final thing I would say is that don't ever give up your faith in Jesus. I wrote the book of John to inspire belief in Jesus. I wrote the epistles to keep you sound and grounded in the teachings of Jesus. And I wrote the book of Revelation for you to know the outcome of your faith in Jesus. Whatever you do, don't quit. Satan, read Revelation. Satan is going to throw everything at you, but you don't quit. In the book of Revelation, it talks some about idolatry and all the problems going on there. You don't have that same idolatry, but you have all kinds of other idols. From success and fame to fortune to time to people to family to pleasure, recreation, I could list on and on. You can commit the same sin that we committed years ago by bowing down to idols. Don't give in to idolatry. Keep your faith in Jesus. My little children, find the balance in love and truth. My little children, love one another. My little children, keep believing in Jesus. Today in the church, I hear you have an invitation. If you need to respond publicly to that invitation, if you want to put Christ on in baptism the same way we did back then, we give you an opportunity as together we stand and sing.